Side 14. Chapter 16. The Elders of Ozone. The god whom science recognizes must be a god of universal laws exclusively, a god who does a wholesale, not a retail business. He cannot accommodate his processes to the convenience of individuals. William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience, 1902. At a few hundred kilometers altitude, the earth fills half your sky, and the band of blue that stretches from Mindanao to Bombay, which your eye encompasses in a single glance, can break your heart with its beauty. Home, you think. Home. This is my world. This is where I come from. Everyone I know, everyone I ever heard of, grew up down there, under that relentless and exquisite blue. You race eastward from horizon to horizon, from dawn to dawn, circling the planet in an hour and a half. After a while, you get to know it. You study its idiosyncrasies and anomalies. You can see so much with the naked eye. Florida will soon be in view again. Has that tropical storm system you saw last orbit, swirling and racing over the Caribbean, reached Fort Lauderdale? Are any of the mountains in the Hindu Kush snow-free this summer? You tend to admire the aquamarine reefs in the Coral Sea. You look at the West Antarctic ice pack and wonder whether its collapse could really inundate all the coastal cities on the planet. In the daylight, though, it's hard to see any sign of human habitation. But at night, except for the polar aurora, everything you see is due to humans humming and blinking all over the planet. That swath of light is eastern North America, continuous from Boston to Washington, a megalopolis in fact, if not in name. Over there is the burn-off of natural gas in Libya. The dazzling lights of the Japanese shrimp fishing fleet have moved toward the South China Sea. On every orbit, the Earth tells you new stories. You can see a volcanic eruption in Kamchatka, a Saharan sandstorm approaching Brazil, unseasonably frigid weather in New Zealand. You get to thinking of the Earth as an organism, a living thing. You get to worry about it, care for it, wish it well. National boundaries are as invisible as meridians of longitude, or the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn. The boundaries are arbitrary. The planet is real. Spaceflight, therefore, is subversive. If they are fortunate enough to find themselves in Earth orbit, most people, after a little meditation, have similar thoughts. The nations that had instituted spaceflight had done so largely for nationalistic reasons. It was a small irony that almost everyone who entered space received a startling glimpse of a transnational perspective of the Earth as one world. It wasn't hard to imagine a time when the predominant loyalty would be to this blue world, or even to the cluster of worlds huddling around the nearby yellow dwarf star, on which humans, once unaware that every star is a sun, had bestowed the definite article, the sun. It was only now, when many people were entering space for long periods and had been afforded a little time for reflection, that the power of the planetary perspective began to be felt. A significant number of these occupants of low Earth orbit, it turned out, were influential down there on Earth. They had, from the beginning, from before humans ever entered space, sent animals up there. Amoebas, fruit flies, rats, dogs, and apes had become hardy space veterans. As space flights of longer and longer duration became possible, something unexpected was found. It had no effect on microorganisms and little effect on fruit flies. But for mammals, it seemed, zero gravity extended the lifespan by 10 or 20%. If you lived in zero G, your body would spend less energy fighting the force of gravity. Your cells would oxidize more slowly, and you would live longer. There were some physicians who claimed that the effects would be much more pronounced on humans than on rats. There was the faintest aroma of immortality in the air. The rate of new cancers was down 80% for the orbital animals compared with a control group on the Earth. Leukemia and lymphatic carcinomas were down 90%. There was even some evidence, perhaps not yet statistically significant, that the spontaneous remission rate for neoplastic diseases was much greater in zero gravity. The German chemist Otto Warburg had half a century before proposed that oxidation was the cause of many cancers. The lower cellular oxygen consumption in the weightless condition suddenly seemed very attractive. People who in earlier decades would have made a pilgrimage to Mexico for latrile now clamored for a ticket into space, but the price was exorbitant. Whether preventive or clinical medicine, spaceflight was for the few. Suddenly, hitherto unheard-of sums of money became available for investment in civilian orbital stations. By the very end of the second millennium, there were rudimentary retirement hotels a few hundred kilometers up. Aside from the expense, there was a serious disadvantage, of course. Progressive osteological and vascular damage would make it impossible for you ever to come back to the gravitational field at the surface of the Earth. But for some of the wealthy elderly, this was no major impediment. In exchange for another decade of life, they were happy to retire to the sky and eventually to die there. There were those who worried that this was an imprudent investment of the limited wealth of the planet. There were too many urgent needs and just grievances of the poor and powerless to spend it on pampering the rich and powerful. It was foolhardy, they said, to permit an elite class to emigrate to space with the masses left back on Earth, a planet in effect given over to absentee landlords. Others professed it to be a godsend. The owners of the planet were picking up in droves and leaving. They couldn't do nearly as much damage up there, it was argued, as down here. Hardly anyone anticipated the principal outcome, the transfer of a vivid planetary perspective to those who could do the most good. After some years, there were few nationalists left in Earth orbit. Global nuclear confrontation poses real problems for those with a penchant for immortality. There were Japanese industrialists, Greek shipping tycoons, Saudi crown princes, one ex-president, a former party general secretary, a Chinese robber baron, and a retired heroin kingpin. In the West, aside from a few promotional invitations, there was only one criterion for residence in Earth orbit. You had to be able to pay. The Soviet hostel was different. It was called a space station, and the former party secretary was said to be there for gerontological research. By and large, the multitudes were not resentful. One day, they imagined, they would go too. Those in Earth orbit tended to be circumspect, careful, quiet. Their families and staffs had similar personal qualities. They were the focus of discreet attention by other rich and powerful people still on Earth. They made no public pronouncements, but their views gradually permeated the thinking of leaders worldwide. The continuing divestment of nuclear weapons by the five nuclear powers was something the venerables in orbit supported. Quietly, they had endorsed the building of the machine because of its potential to unify the world. Occasionally, nationalist organizations would write about a vast conspiracy in Earth orbit, doddering do-gooders selling out their motherlands. There were pamphlets that purported to be stenographic transcripts of a meeting aboard Methuselah, attended by representatives of the other private space stations who had been ferried over for the purpose. A list of action items was produced, calculated to strike terror in the heart of the most lukewarm patriot. The pamphlets were spurious, Times Week announced. It called them the Protocols of the Elders of Ozone. On the days immediately before launch, she tried to spend some time, often just after dawn, on Cocoa Beach. Ellie had borrowed an apartment that overlooked the beach and the Atlantic Ocean. She would bring pieces of bread along and practice throwing them to the seagulls. They were good at catching morsels on the fly, with a fielding average, she calculated, about that of a major league outfielder. There were moments when 20 or 30 seagulls would hover in the air just a meter or two above her head. They flapped vigorously to stay in place, their beaks wide, straining in anticipation of the miraculous appearance of food. They grazed past each other in apparent random motion, but the overall effect was a stationary pattern. On her way back, She noticed a small and, in its humble way, perfect palm frond lying at the edge of the beach. She picked it up and carried it back to her apartment, carefully wiping off the sand with her fingers. Haddon had invited her up for a visit to his home away from home, his chateau in space. Methuselah, he called it. She could tell no one outside the government about the invitation because of Haddon's passion to stay out of the public eye. Indeed, it was still not generally known that he had taken up residence in orbit, retired to the sky. All those inside the government, she asked, were for it. Terhir's advice was, "The change of scene will do you good." The president clearly was in favor of her visit, because a place had suddenly been made available on the next shuttle launch, the aging STS Intrepid. Passage to an orbiting rest home was usually by commercial carrier. A much larger, non-reusable launch vehicle was undergoing final flight qualification. But the aging shuttle fleet was still the workhorse of U.S. government space activities, both military and civilian.
"We just flake off tiles by the handful when we re-enter, and then we just stick 'em back on again before liftoff," one of the astronaut pilots explained to her.
Beyond general good health, there were no special physical requirements for the flight. Commercial launches tended to go up full and come back empty. By contrast, the shuttle flights were crowded both on the way up and on the way down. Before Intrepid's latest landing, the previous week, it had rendezvoused and docked with Methuselah to return two passengers to Earth. She recognized their names. One was a designer of propulsion systems, the other a cryobiologist. Ellie wondered what they had been doing on Methuselah.
You'll see, the pilot continued. It'll be like falling off a log. Hardly anybody hates it. And most folks just love it.
She did. Crowded in with the pilot, two mission specialists, a tight-lipped military officer, and an employee of the Internal Revenue Service, she experienced a flawless liftoff and the exhilaration of her first experience in zero gravity longer than the ride in the high deceleration elevator at the World Trade Center in New York. 1.5 orbits later, they rendezvoused with Methuselah. In 2 days, the commercial transport Narnia would bring Ellie down. The chateau, Haddon insisted on calling it that, was slowly spinning. One revolution about every 90 minutes, so that the same side of it was always facing the Earth. Haddon's study featured a magnificent panorama on the Earthward bulkhead, not a television screen, but a real transparent window. The photons she was seeing had been reflected off the snowy Andes just a fraction of a second ago. Except toward the periphery of the window where the slant path through the thick polymer was longer, hardly any distortion was evident. There were many people she knew, even people who considered themselves religious, for whom the feeling of awe was an embarrassment. But you would have to be made of wood, she thought, to stand before this window and not feel it. They should be sending up young poets and composers, artists, filmmakers, and deeply religious people, not wholly in thrall to the sectarian bureaucracies. This experience could easily be conveyed, she thought, to the average person on Earth. What a pity it had not yet been attempted seriously. The feeling was numinous.
"You get used to it," Haddon told her.
"But you don't get tired of it. From time to time, it's still inspiring." Abstemiously, he was nursing a diet cola. She had refused the offer of something stronger. The premium on ethanol in orbit must be high, she thought. Of course you miss things. Long walks, swimming in the ocean, old friends dropping in unannounced. But I was never much into those things anyway. And as you see, friends can come by for a visit. At huge expense, she replied. A woman comes up to visit Yamagishi, my neighbor in the next wing. Second Tuesday of every month, rain or shine. I'll introduce you to him later. He's quite a guy. Class A war criminal, but only indicted, you understand, never convicted.
What's the attraction? She asked. You don't think the world is about to end. What are you doing up here?
I like the view,
And there are certain legal niceties. She looked at him querulously.
You know, someone in my position, new inventions, new industries, is always on the thin edge of breaking some law or other.
Usually, it's because the old laws haven't caught up with the new technology. You can spend a lot of your time in litigation. It cuts down your effectiveness, while all this, he gestured expansively, taking in both the chateau and the earth, doesn't belong to any nation. This chateau belongs to me, my friend Yamagishi, and a few others. There could never be anything illegal about supplying me with food and material needs. Just to be on the safe side, though, we're working on closed ecological systems. There's no extradition treaty between this chateau and any of the nations down there. It's more efficient for me to be up here. I don't want you to think that I've done anything really illegal. But we're doing so many new things. It's smart to be on the safe side. For instance, there are people who actually believe I sabotaged the machine when I spent a ridiculous amount of my own money trying to build it. And you know what they did to Babylon. My insurance investigators think it might have been the same people in Babylon and Terre Haute. I seem to have a lot of enemies. I don't understand why. I think I've done a lot of good for people. Anyway, all in all, it's better for me to be up here. Now, it's the machine I wanted to talk to you about. That was awful. That erbium dowel catastrophe in Wyoming. I'm really sorry about Drumlin. He was a tough old pisser. And it must have been a big shock for you. Sure you don't want a drink? But she was content to look out at the earth and listen. If I'm not disheartened about the machine, he went on, I don't see why you should be. You're probably worried that there never will be an American machine, that there are too many people who want it to fail. The president's worried about the same thing. And those factories we built, those aren't assembly lines. We've been making custom-made products. It's going to be expensive to replace all the broken parts. But mainly you're thinking, maybe it was a bad idea in the first place. Maybe we've been foolish to go so fast. So, let's take a long, careful look at the whole thing. Even if you're not thinking like that, the president is. But if we don't do it soon, I'm worried we'll never do it. And there's another thing, I don't think this invitation is open forever. Funny you should say that. That's just what Valerian, Drumlin, and I were talking about before the accident. The sabotage, she corrected herself. Please, go on. You see, the religious people, most of them, really think this planet is an experiment. That's what their beliefs come down to. Some god or other is always fixing and poking, messing around with tradesmen's wives, giving tablets on mountains, commanding you to mutilate your children, telling people what words they can say and what words they can't say, making people feel guilty about enjoying themselves, and like that. Why can't the gods leave well enough alone? All this intervention speaks of incompetence. If God didn't want Lot's wife to look back, why didn't he make her obedient so she'd do what her husband told her? Or if he hadn't made Lot such a shithead, maybe she would have listened to him more. If God is omnipotent and omniscient, why didn't he start the universe out in the first place so it would come out the way he wants? Why is he constantly repairing and complaining? No, there's one thing the Bible makes clear. The biblical God is a sloppy manufacturer. He's not good at design. He's not good at execution. He'd be out of business if there was any competition. That's why I don't believe we're an experiment. There might be lots of experimental planets in the universe, places where apprentice gods get to test out their skills. What a shame Rankin and Joss weren't born on one of those planets. But on this planet, again he waved at the window, there isn't any micro-intervention. The gods don't drop in on us to fix things up when we've botched it. You look at human history, and it's clear we've been on our own. Until now, she said. Deus ex machina? That's what you think? You think the gods finally took pity on us and sent the machine? Oh, more like machina ex deo. Oh, whatever the right Latin is. No, I don't think we're the experiment. I think we're the control. The planet that nobody was interested in, the place where nobody intervened at all.
A calibration world gone to seed. This is what happens if they don't intervene. The Earth is an object lesson for the apprentice gods. If you really screw up, they get told, you'll make something like Earth. But of course, it'd be a waste to destroy a perfectly good world. So they look in on us from time to time, just in case. Maybe each time they bring by the gods who screwed up. Last time they looked, we're frolicking in the savannas, trying to outrace the antelopes. Okay, that's fine, they say. These guys aren't going to give us any trouble. Look in on them in another 10 million years. But just to be on the safe side, monitor them at radio frequencies. Then one day, there's an alarm, a message from Earth. What? They have television already? Let's see what they're into. Olympic Stadium, national flags, bird of prey, Adolf Hitler, thousands of cheering people. Uh-oh, they say. They know the warning signs. Quick as a flash, they tell us, cut it out, you guys. That's a perfectly good planet you have there, disorganized but serviceable. Here, build this machine instead. They're worried about us. They see we're on a downward slope. They think we should be in a hurry to get repaired. So I think so, too. We have to build the machine. She knew what Drumlin would have thought of arguments like this. Although much that Haddon had just said resonated with her own thinking, she was tired of these beguiling and confident speculations on what the Vegans had in mind. She wanted the project to continue, the machine completed and activated, the new stage in human history begun. She still mistrusted her own motives, was still wary even when she was mentioned as a possible member of the crew on a completed machine. So the delays in resuming construction served a purpose for her. They bought time for her to work her problems through. We'll have dinner with Yamagishi. You'll like him. But we're a little worried about him. He keeps his oxygen partial pressure so low at night. What do you mean? Well, the lower the oxygen content in the air, the longer you live. At least that's what the doctors tell us. So we all get to pick the amount of oxygen in our rooms. In daytime, you can't bring it much below 20% because you get groggy. It impairs mental functioning. But at night, when you're sleeping anyway, you can lower the oxygen partial pressure. There's a danger, though. You can lower it too much. Yamagishi's down to 14% these days because he wants to live forever. As a result, he's not lucid until lunchtime. I've been that way all my life at 20% oxygen, she laughed. Now he's experimenting with nootropic drugs to remove the grogginess. You know, like paracetam. They definitely improve memory. I don't know that it actually makes you smarter, but that's what they say. So Yamagishi is taking an awful lot of nootropics, and he's not breathing enough oxygen at night. So does he behave cuckoo? Cuckoo is hard to tell. I don't know very many 92-year-old Class A war criminals. That's why every experiment needs a control, she said. He smiled. Even at his advanced age, Yamagishi displayed the erect bearing he had acquired during his long service in the Imperial Army. He was a small man, entirely bald, with an inconspicuous white mustache and a fixed, benign expression on his face. I am here because of hips, he explained. I know about cancer and lifetimes, but I am here because of hips. At my age, bones break easily. Baron Tsukama died from falling from his futon onto his tatami. 1.5 meter, he fell. 1.5 meter. And his bones broke. In zero G, hips do not break. This seemed very sensible. A few gastronomic compromises had been made, but the dinner was of surprising elegance. A specialized small technology had been developed for weightless dining. Serving utensils had lids. Wine glasses had tops and straws. Foods such as nuts or dried cornflakes were prohibited. Yamagishi urged the caviar on her. It was one of the few Western foods, he explained, that cost more per kilogram to buy on Earth than to ship to space. The cohesion of the individual caviar eggs was a lucky break, Ellie mused.
She tried to imagine thousands of separate eggs in individual freefall, clouding the passageways of this orbiting retirement home. Suddenly she remembered that her mother was also in a retirement home, several orders of magnitude more modest than this one. In fact, orienting herself by the Great Lakes, visible out the window at this moment, she could pinpoint her mother's location. She could spend 2 days chatting it up in Earth orbit with bad boy billionaires, but couldn't spare 15 minutes for a phone call with her mother? She promised herself to call as soon as she landed in Cocoa Beach. A communique from Earth orbit, she told herself, might be too much novelty for the senior citizen's rest home in Janesville, Wisconsin. Yamagishi interrupted her train of thought to inform her that he was the oldest man in space. Ever. Even the former Chinese vice premier was younger. He removed his coat, rolled up his right sleeve, flexed his biceps, and asked her to feel his muscle. He was soon full of vivid and quantitative detail about the worthy charities to which he had been a major contributor. She tried to make polite conversation. "It's very placid and quiet up here. You must be enjoying your retirement." She had addressed this bland remark to Yamagishi, but hadn't replied. "It's not entirely uneventful. Occasionally there's a crisis and we have to move fast."
"Solar flare. Extremely bad. Make you sterile," Yamagishi volunteered.
"Yeah, if there's a major solar flare monitored by telescope, you have about 3 days before the charged particles hit the chateau. So the permanent residents like Yamagishi-san and me, we go to the storm shelter. Very smart and very confined. But it has enough radiation shielding to make a difference. There's some secondary radiation, of course. The thing is, all the non-permanent staff and visitors have to leave in the 3-day period. That kind of an emergency can tax the commercial fleet. Sometimes we have to call in NASA or the Soviets to rescue people. You wouldn't believe who you flush out in solar flare events. Mafiosi, heads of intelligence services, beautiful men and women. Why do I get the feeling that sex is high on the list of imports from Earth?" she asked a little reluctantly. "Oh, it is, it is. There's lots of reasons. The clientele, the location. But the main reason is zero-G. In zero-G, you can do things at 80 you never thought possible at 20. You ought to take a vacation up here with your boyfriend. Consider it a definite invitation."
90, said Yamagishi.
"I beg your pardon?"
"You can do things at 90 you didn't dream of at 20. That's what Yamagishi-san is saying. That's why everyone wants to come up here."
Over coffee, Hadden returned to the topic of the machine. "Yamagishi-san and me are partners with some other people. He's the honorary chairman of the board of Yamagishi Industries. As you know, they're the prime contractor for the machine component testing going on in Hokkaido. Now imagine our problem. I'll give you a for instance. There are 3 big spherical shells, one inside the other. They're made of a niobium alloy. They have peculiar patterns cut into them. And they're obviously designed to rotate in 3 orthogonal directions very fast in a vacuum. Benzels, they're called. You know all this, of course. What happens if you make a scale model of the 3 benzels and spin them very fast? What happens?" All knowledgeable physicists think nothing will happen. But, of course, nobody's done the experiment. This precise experiment. So nobody really knows. Suppose something does happen when the full machine is activated. Does it depend on the speed of rotation? Does it depend on the composition of the benzels, on the pattern of the cutouts? Is it a question of scale? So we've been building these things and running them, scale models and full-scale copies both. We want to spin our version of the big benzels, the ones that'll be mated to the other components in the 2 machines. Suppose nothing happens then. Then we'd want to add additional components one by one. We'd keep plugging them in a small systems integration job at every step. And then maybe there'd be a time when we plug in a component, not the last one, and the machine does something that knocks our socks off. We're only trying to figure out how the machine works. You see what I'm driving at? You mean you've been secretly assembling an identical copy of the machine in Japan?
Well, it's not exactly a secret. We're testing out the individual components. Nobody said we could only test them one at a time.
So here's what Yamagishi-san and I propose. We change the schedule on the experiments in Hokkaido. We do full-up systems integration now, and if nothing works, we'll do the component-by-component testing later. The money's all been allocated anyway. We think it'll be months, maybe years, before the American effort gets back on track. And we don't think the Russians can do it even in that time. Japan's the only possibility. We don't have to announce it right away. We don't have to make a decision about activating the machine right away. We are just testing components. Can you two make this kind of decision on your own? Oh, it's well within what they call our designated responsibilities. We figure we can catch up to where the Wyoming machine was in about 6 months. We'll have to be much more careful about sabotage, of course. But if the components are okay, I think the machine will be okay. Hokkaido's kind of hard to get to. Then when everything is checked and ready, we can ask the World Machine Consortium if they'd like to give it a try. If the crew is willing, I bet you the consortium will go along. What do you think, Yamagishi-san? Yamagishi had not heard the question. He was softly singing Free Fall to himself. It was a current hit song full of vivid detail about succumbing to temptation in Earth orbit. He did not know all the words, he explained, when the question was repeated. Unperturbed, Haddon continued. Now, some of the components will have been spun or dropped or something. But in any case, they'll have to pass the prescribed tests. I didn't think that would be enough to scare you off. Personally, I mean. Personally? What makes you think I'm going? Nobody's asked me, for one thing, and there are a number of new factors. Well, the probability is very high that the selection committee will ask you, and the president will be for it. Enthusiastically. Come on, he said, grinning. You want to spend your whole life in the sticks? It was cloudy over Scandinavia and the North Sea, and the English Channel was covered with a lacy, almost transparent cobweb of fog.
Yes. You go.
Yamagishi was on his feet, his hands stiffly at his sides. He gave her a deep bow.
Speaking for the 22 million employees of the corporations I control, very nice to meet you.
She dozed fitfully in the sleeping cubicle they had assigned her. It was tethered loosely to two walls so she would not, in the course of turning over in zero-G, propel herself against some obstacle. She awoke while everyone else seemed to be still asleep, and pulled herself along a series of handholds until she found herself before the grand window. They were over the night side. The earth was in darkness except for a patchwork and sprinkle of light, the plucky attempt of humans to compensate for the opacity of the earth when their hemisphere was averted from the sun. 20 minutes later at sunrise, she decided that if they asked her, she would say yes. Haddon came up behind her and she started just a little. It looks great, I admit. I've been up here for years and it still looks great. But doesn't it bother you that there's a spaceship around you? See, there's an experience no one's ever had yet. You're in a spacesuit. There's no tether, no spacecraft. Maybe the sun is behind you and you're surrounded on all sides by stars. Maybe the earth is below you, or maybe some other planet. I kind of fancy Saturn myself. There you are, floating in space, like you really are one with the cosmos. Spacesuits nowadays have enough consumables to last you for hours. The spacecraft that dropped you off could be long gone. Maybe they'll rendezvous with you in an hour? Maybe not. The best would be if the ship wasn't coming back, your last hours surrounded by space and stars and worlds. If you had an incurable disease, or if you just wanted to give yourself a really nifty last indulgence, how could you top that? You're serious? You want to market this scheme? Well, too soon to market. Maybe it's not exactly the right way to go about it. Let's just say I'm thinking of feasibility testing. She decided that she would not tell Haddon of her decision, and he did not ask. Later, as the Narnia was beginning its rendezvous and docking with Methuselah, Haddon took her aside. "We were saying that Yamagishi is the oldest person up here. Well, if you talk about permanently up here, I don't mean staff and astronauts and dancing girls. I'm the youngest person up here. I've got a vested interest in the answer, I know. But it's a definite medical possibility that zero-G will keep me alive for centuries. See, I'm engaged in an experiment on immortality. Now, I'm not bringing this up so I can boast. I'm bringing it up for a practical reason. If we're figuring out ways to extend our lifespans, think of what those creatures on Vega must have done. They probably are immortal, or close enough. I'm a practical person, and I've thought a lot now about immortality. I've probably thought longer and more seriously about it than anybody else. And I can tell you one thing for sure about immortals. They're very careful. They don't leave things to chance. They've invested too much effort in becoming immortal. I don't know what they look like. I don't know what they want from you. But if you ever get to see them, this is the only piece of practical advice I have for you. Something you think is dead cinch safe, they'll consider an unacceptable risk. If there's any negotiating you get to do up there, don't forget what I'm telling you. Chapter 17. The Dream of the Ants. Human speech is like a cracked kettle on which we tap crude rhythms for bears to dance to, while we long to make music that will melt the stars. Gustave Flaubert, Madame Bovary, 1857. Popular theology is a massive inconsistency derived from ignorance. The gods exist because nature herself has imprinted a conception of them on the minds of men. Cicero, De Natura Deorum, 1:16. Ellie was in the midst of packing notes, magnetic tapes, and a palm frond for shipment to Japan when she received word that her mother had suffered a stroke. Immediately afterward, she was brought a letter by Project Courier. It was from John Staunton, and there were no polite preliminaries. "Your mother and I would often discuss your deficiencies and shortcomings. It was always a difficult conversation. When I defended you, and although you may not believe it, this happened often, she told me that I was putty in your hands. When I criticized you, she told me to mind my own business. But I want you to know that your unwillingness to visit her in the last few years since this Vega business was a source of continuing pain to her. She would tell her cronies at that dreadful nursing home she insisted on going to that you'd be visiting her soon. For years she told them that. Soon. She planned how she would show her famous daughter around, in what order she'd introduce you to that decrepit bunch. You probably won't want to hear this, and I tell it to you with sorrow. But it's for your own good. Your behavior was more painful to her than anything that ever happened to her, even your father's death. You may be a big shot now, your hologram available all over the world, hobnobbing with politicians and so on. But as a human being, you haven't learned anything since high school." Her eyes welling with tears, she began to crumple the letter and its envelope, but discovered some stiff piece of paper inside. A partial hologram made from an old two-dimensional photograph by a computer extrapolation technique. You had a faint but satisfactory sense of being able to see around edges and corners. It was a photo she had never seen before. Her mother as a young woman, quite lovely, smiled out of the picture, her arm casually draped over the shoulder of Ellie's father, who sported what seemed to be a day's growth of beard. They both seemed radiantly happy. With a surge of anguish, guilt, fury at Staunton, and a little self-pity, Ellie weighed the evident reality that she would never see either of the people in that picture again. Her mother lay immobile in the bed. Her expression was oddly neutral, registering neither joy nor regret, merely a kind of waiting. Her only motion was an occasional blink of her eyes. Whether she could hear or understand what Ellie was saying was unclear. Ellie thought about communication schemes. She couldn't help it. The thought arose unbidden. One blink for yes, two blinks for no. Or hook up an encephalograph with a cathode ray tube that her mother could see and teach her to modulate her beta waves. But this was her mother, not Alpha Lyrae. And what was called for here was not decryption algorithms, but feeling. She held her mother's hand and talked for hours. She rambled on about her mother and her father, her childhood. She recalled being a toddler among the newly washed sheets, being swept up to the sky. She talked about John Staunton. She apologized for many things. She cried a little. Her mother's hair was awry, and finding a brush, she prettified her. She examined the lined face and recognized her own. Her mother's eyes, deep and moist, stared fixedly, with only an occasional blink into it seemed a great distance. "I know where I come from," Ellie told her softly. Almost imperceptibly, her mother shook her head from side to side, as though she were regretting all those years in which she and her daughter had been estranged. Ellie gave her mother's hand a little squeeze and thought she felt one in return. Her mother's life was not in danger, she was told. If there was any change in her condition, they would call at once to her office in Wyoming. In a few days, they would be able to move her from the hospital back to the nursing home where the facilities, she was assured, were adequate. Staunton seemed subdued, but with a depth of feeling for her mother she had not guessed at. She would call often, she told him. The austere marble lobby displayed, perhaps incongruously, a real statue, not a holograph, of a nude woman in the style of Praxiteles. They ascended in an Otis Hitachi elevator, in which the second language was English rather than Braille, and she found herself ushered through a large barn of a room in which people were huddled over word processors. A word would be typed in hiragana, the 51-letter Japanese phonetic alphabet, and on the screen would appear the corresponding Chinese ideogram in kanji. There were hundreds of thousands of such ideograms or characters stored in the computer memories, although only 3,000 or 4,000 were generally needed to read a newspaper. Because many characters of entirely different meanings were expressed by the same spoken word, all possible translations into kanji were printed out in order of probability. The word processor had a contextual subroutine in which the candidate characters were also cued according to the computer's estimate of the intended meaning. It was rarely wrong. In a language which had until recently never had a typewriter, the word processor was working a communications revolution not fully admired by traditionalists. End of side 14.